Could this be the best week ever for British cinema? This weekend, Bond is back in Quantum of Solace. Terence Davis's Of Time and the City takes film into the realms of poetry, and Steve McQueen's Hunger, a work where cinema meets art and British political history, which has garnered awards all over the world. All of these films are released this weekend. Surely this is British cinema at its most diverse and at its best. It's enough to bring a tear to your patriotic eye. Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and this is a Very British Film Weekly. On this week's show, I'll be talking to Quantum of Solace director Mark Forster about his new vision of 007. And this week, one of the country's finest actors, Ralph Fiennes, received the Variety UK Achievement in Film Award at the London Film Festival. I speak to Ralph about his career thus far. And the nominations for this year's British Independent Film Awards, or the BIFFAs, were announced this week, with five going to director Erin Creevy's debut film, Shifty. We'll be catching up with Erin to find out how that feels and how he managed to make such a big film on a tiny budget. Of course, roving Guardian film critic Zan Brooks will be along, wrapped in a Union Jack, to review all of these fine British offerings. But first... Quantum of Solace is the 22nd film in the Bond series, and the second outing for Daniel Craig after Casino Royale. It might be Daniel's second crack at 007, but for director Mark Forster, it's the first, and a very odd project on his CV to date. Forster's previous films are defined by their subtlety, a delicate rendering of character, and a distinct lack of car chases. Starting with Halle Berry and that Oscar in Monsters Ball in 2001, Forster has since directed Johnny Depp in Finding Neverland, Will Ferrell in Stranger Than Fiction in 2006, and most recently, a screen adaptation of the novel The Kite Runner. So when I met up with Mark Forster this week, I started out by asking him if he was surprised to have been offered the role of directing Bond 22.
Yeah, no, it was interesting when my agent first called me and said, Barbara Broccoli, Michael Wilson want to meet you and they want to offer you the next Bond movie. I said, are you sure you didn't get you got the right number, or you didn't mix this up? She said, no, they really want to meet you. And at the beginning, I was very hesitant and very suspicious, because, you know, it's been such a incredible, like, the franchise, and it's the 22nd one. And I felt like I'm sure that the producers would be very, very controlling, and I thought maybe I meet them and said, this is the Bible of Bond. and this is sort of the rules you have to follow.
Were you a fan of Bond?
I liked Bond. I liked I always watched them, but I wouldn't say I was a diehard fan.
Yeah. I mean, was he, because you grew up in Switzerland, was he always on television there?
Oh yeah, he's a bit huge in Switzerland, and he, you know, like, Bond shot several times in Switzerland. So no, it was definitely it's enormously big.
Yeah, I find it quite odd. I don't think Roger Moore, actually, who was a Bond, lives in Switzerland, doesn't he?
I believe he has a house there. Yes.
Yes, there you go. So there it does all come together. Yeah. And I have to say, watching this Quantum of Solace, and I mean this in as a compliment, it seemed quite Swiss.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I like to run my sets, to be very precise. And it's actually the first Bond film, you know, was scheduled for 103 days, and we finished it after 103 days. And Barbara came to me and said to me, this is the first Bond film ever where we didn't go over.
Well, there you go. That's what Swiss timing. Exactly. I suppose there's Swiss cheese as well, which would mean it would be full of holes, which it isn't, I have to say.
Good, I'm glad.
It's very tight. Yeah. I mean, I think what also appealed about the Swissness of it was that I found it a very clean Bond. I found it very chiseled. And Bond himself was a precision tool in it. I mean, this was a Bond who knew what he was going for and was not going to stop. I loved Daniel Craig in this. He was a totally different Bond. I think for the first time, it's a real contribution to, let's call it a genre now. I suppose after 22, we can do that. Is that how you approached it, as a genre pick?
Yes, very, very much I approached it as a genre pick. And also, I felt like, you know, that Daniel Craig's interpretation of Bond is much closer to the way Ian Fleming wrote Bond than ever anybody has done before. And I felt, you know, I wanted to make it very lean and sort of mean, but to really start the movie right in the middle of the car, of a car chase, and really have the sort of the audience at the edge of their seats until sort of the last frame.
Yeah, no, it worked for me as well, I have to say, which has been, it's been a long time since I've enjoyed Bonds. Yeah. I've laughed at them, I've thought they were ridiculous, I've kind of entertained by them, but this one I was actually gripped by, but gripped in the way that Daniel was gripped in Casino Royale, by the balls, I think.
That's what sort of my intention, to grip the audience by the balls and just like take them on this journey and not let them go until the movie is done.
Yeah, I mean, it's exhausting to watch in a way. Is it exhausting to make such a thing? Because you're in so many locations.
It was definitely exhausting, but at the same time, you know, you had the producers really supported my vision so much that it was actually not as difficult as it seems. You know, like a film, for instance, like Kite Runner, I just did before this, was very hard to make because it's subtitled, I don't have a movie star, so the studio is very reluctant to giving you more money, and you had constantly have to make sure you can make your days, and it's much, it was really emotionally, psychologically really exhausting. On top, you have the similar pressure because it's about a book that sold 8 million copies. And now on a Bond movie, of course, the expectations are even higher, the pressure is even bigger, but you have a team in place which can really support the director's vision.
And unusually, I suppose, for recent Bonds it's the case, but you don't have a book on which to base it. I mean, when Casino Royale actually had a book. So this was one that you had to kind of come up with the idea and come up with the script.
No, it was a little crazy at the beginning because I signed on and I said, look, we have a release date, beginning of November 2008, but we haven't finished script. And I'm like traveling the world and scouting for these Bond locations without having a finished script. And it was like a little crazy. And there was moments I was thinking, can I do that? What did I get myself into? But in the same time, you know, I was pushing also like, let's not shoot the movie on a studio. Let's really go on location and try to shoot it at an as many interesting location as possible to make it more real and visually sort of spectacular.
Which I think worked. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned The Kite Runner because that had a lot of desertscapes in it and as you say, I think looked like hard work to make. But here, of course, you have a climax in an extraordinary desert as well. Mm. So you've got very good at shooting rocks, I think, in the last few years.
Yes, it's my new speciality I put on my CV. Very good in shooting rocks from all sorts of angles. But I felt like, you know, that Bond in the desert is an interesting concept because it's sort of isolated. Mm. It's sort of, I never have seen it in a Bond film. Mm. And I also felt like it's sort of like this loneliness. And that's what Bond is really about in this movie. There's this incredible loneliness in him.
I think, whether I knew this or not, but knowing that, in a way, this was a Bond that slightly had a more auteur-ish hand to it. It was, in a way, it's a director's movie. I know Daniel's very much the centre of it as well, and it's a collaboration between the two of you. In fact, he reminded me very much of Lee Marvin in John Borman's 1967 film Point Blank, where he was very much a product of San Francisco, of the modernism of the environment. He just kept walking.
Actually one of the films I looked at. It was Point Blank. Yeah. No, I was very inspired by those sort of late 60s, early 70s sort of thrillers and action films because they had that leanness to them. And I always felt like, you know, Daniel has this quality of Stephen McQueen, Lee Marvin. And I felt like that the idea was for me to really make it more auteur-driven, character-driven in a sense, and sort of bring my sensibility in. And at the beginning I thought, oh, maybe, you know, there's this given Bond framework, but within that framework I still wanted to make the film my own.
Mark Forster there, and Quantum of Solace, in case you hadn't noticed, is released this Friday, 31st of October. It will be everywhere, you have been warned. And if you want to hear and see the full-length version of that interview with Mark Forster, complete with me and Daniel Craig in Vision, just go to In the Director's Chair, my new series of director's interview on the Guardian website, www.guardian.co.uk/video. Now, joining me in the studio to review this week's releases is Guardian film critic at large, Zan Brooks. Hello, Zan.
Hello.
Welcome back to the pod. Have you had a nice final week at the LFF?
It's winding down now, but it's been good, I think.
Yeah, it has been good. Now, all of these films that we're about to review this week have appeared at the LFF in some way, but they're all also on national release this week, finally, because of Time in the City, which we'll talk about later, the Terrence Davis film, and Hunger, the Steve McQueen film. We talked about it in our Cannes special way back when. I'm sure you remember that in May, but they're finally here to talk about. But first, we must talk about James Bond, A Quantum of Solace, Bond 22, or Bond 22, perhaps we should call it, because this is the most auteurish effort in the Bond series so far, in my opinion. Mark Forster directing Bond. We pick up the action an hour after the end of Casino Royale, although I don't think that's particularly a bit of information that's very necessary to enjoy Quantum of Solace, Zan, do you?
No, not at all. I mean, it's a sequel of sorts, but you could probably go into it without knowing anything about Casino Royale and still get a lot out of this, I think.
So basically, for anyone that didn't see Casino Royale, there are about three people in the world who didn't. Vespa Lynd, who was played by Eva Green, she died. She was killed, perhaps by a kind of strange organisation.
A falling piazza, wasn't it, in Venice?
It was. That can happen to anyone. And maybe she betrayed Bond. Anyway, he is now looking for his Quantum of Solace. They found a body, and M and him are about to interrogate him.
Vespa's boyfriend, Youssef Kabira, the one who was abducted in Morocco, the one she was trying to save, his body was washed up on a beach in Ibiza. We're meant to believe the fish did that to his face. His wallet and ID were in his pocket.
Oh, that's convenient.
Quite. Which is why I did a DNA check on a lock of his hair found in Vespa's apartment. It's not him.
A lock of his hair? I wouldn't have thought Vespa the sentimental type.
Well, we never really know anyone, do we? But I do need to know, Bond. I need to know that I can trust you.
And you don't?
Well, it'd be a pretty cold bastard who didn't want revenge for the death of someone he loved.
You don't have to worry about me. I'm not going to go chasing him. He's not important. And neither was she.
Ooh, Daniel. A pretty cold bastard. It's always great to hear Judi Dench swear, and here she is as M swearing.
It's interesting, though. You seem to have isolated one of the very few sort of bits of dialogue from the film. This isn't a film where they talk very much.
No, they've got things to do.
Yeah, they've got things to do. This isn't the sort of the Roger Moore Bond where he's kind of quipping and chatting and flirting the whole time. And it's interesting you were saying that this is a sort of auteurist Bond of Mark Forster directing it. I almost see it as the other way. I almost see this as like the second unit Bond. This is like a Bond with almost all the plot, all the kind of bells and whistles just kind of stripped away. Mm. And it's just this kind of hard, lean series of chases and stunts. I mean, there are car chases in here. There's boat chases. There's a plane chase. They chase on foot. If there'd been sort of tricycles sitting around, you know that there'd have been a tricycle race chase at some stage of this film. So
a lot of critics have kind of found that a problem because they missed the elan of Bond.
Yeah. They have, and it seems to be that Quantum Solace is getting a rougher ride than Casino Royale did. Maybe the sort of the novelty's gone. You know, here's Daniel Craig already established in the role, so there's not the sort of the thrill of the new anymore. But I really like this. I thought that this really did the job.
Yeah, I mean, you say that there's all these chases there, and that you know it's just a series of kind of actions that start to go. But in fact, that leanness that actually kind of throws into relief the bits that is talking. Suddenly they come. Yeah. I think they sort of whack you over the head much more, that suddenly I am hearing Judi Dench say bastard, and I'm thinking, wow, and I am seeing Bond. When there's a scene later on where he's, you know, you're thinking, where's the martini shaken, not stirred line? When it comes, he's on a Virgin Atlantic plane, yes, but he's had seven by the time he gets to say what the drink is. I mean, this guy gets sloshed, and in the clip we heard before, he is actually drinking about four double whiskies.
He's a man in crisis, isn't he? And I think Craig communicates that with very little kind of fuss and actorly angst. It has to be said that it's slightly going for the kind of the Bourne vehicle with this.
Yeah, there's a lot of close-up fighting.
There's a lot of close-up fighting and fisticuffs. And
jumping
kind of
from balcony into wall.
Crashing over sort of loose tiles on roofs and things like that. And also, you know, Craig is there with kind of blood splats on his face and his hair must.
Yeah, I mean, I don't recall. I mean, I think Roger Moore had a hair out of place once.
Yeah, I think in Octopussy there was a hair out of place.
Yeah, and I think that Pierce Brosnan, but actually there was one film where Pierce Brosnan got tortured right at the beginning, but other than that he sort of made a quite swift recovery.
Yeah, and it was mainly torturing us, I think, Pierce Brosnan. So I was never a big fan of Pierce.
Well, this is the thing. This is a reaction, surely, to all those all the kind of bonds that have gone further and further and further from the Ian Fleming bond,
which
Dr. No, I think, was quite faithful to. And then sort of as Bond kind of piled up and got to its, you know, mid-15s, it was becoming so bloated and boring as a franchise.
It's a weirdly, deceptively difficult character to play Bond, because he is this sort of hollow man. He's an inherently ludicrous figure, I think. So how do you do it? Do you go the kind of Connery route and play it straight, or do you do the Roger Moore route and basically playing as this sort of parody, this kind of, you know, ludicrous figure?
Yeah. I liked Roger Moore.
I kind of like Roger Moore because we grew up with Roger Moore. That was our sort of reference point. So there's always a sort of fondness for Roger Moore. And I do think that, you know, things like Live and Let Die and The Spy Who Loved Me are great
Bond films.
They're fantastic Bond films. But I think Craig is probably the best Bond because he does it with such confidence and such authority.
And God, does he wear a Tom Ford suit nicely.
He does, you know, and poor Roger maybe didn't quite have that.
No, he is saddled with the safari suit forever, I think.
He was the Cecil Parkinson of Bonds, wasn't he, Roger Moore?
But, I mean, I know it sounds kind of wrong to admire the kind of the frippery, literally, of Bond, the Tom Ford suit, the kind of gating of the tail of it, the tapering of the waist, the white shirt. But I think that these are the things that a modern Bond would actually get really right. He would obsess over getting the right
suit.
There's
always been a weird homoerotic vibe about Bond. He's a very fussy, fastidious man. And I think it's fine that these films honour that.
So that's one British offering this week. Now let's turn to Liverpool, to the 50s, to the misty memories of Terence Davis, the director of Long Day Closes, Distant Voices, Still Lives, and other films like his trilogy. This is more of a documentary memoir, an ode to the city he once knew and is no longer part of, and is no longer there, in fact, of time and the city.
When I was not at the movies, on Friday nights, I was at the Liverpool Stadium watching the wrestling. Not for its pantomimic villainy, but for something more illicit. And in short, I was afraid. As I struggled with my adolescent desires, as I waited at the top of the aisle, as the wrestlers swaggered up from the ring, their trunks tight across the buttocks, I could feel their body heat as I furtively touched a back or a thigh, choking with schoolboy guilt and trembling with the fear of the wrath of God.
I bet Terence Davis is a Daniel Craig fan as well. Terence getting all fruity over his memories of Liverpool there. He does have this wonderful kind of mellifluous, kind of almost Kenneth Williams kind of tone to his voice.
Yeah, so Uncle Monty in With Nail and Eye, perhaps. But he's a very entertaining guide.
Isn't he?
You know, if I'm going to be led around Liverpool by anyone, I think Terence Davis would be the person.
He'd be ahead of sort of Ian Rush or Kenny Dalglish or someone like that.
Or Macca.
Jimmy Tarbuck. This is a strange exercise because it's such a personal memoir, Zan. It's a kind of a treasure trove of archive footage, clips from various kind of archives up and down the country, Movie Tone, Pathé, the Northwest Archive. And it's put to kind of Terence's own memories and poetry and all his normal cinematic life is there. Guilt, Catholicism, homosexuality, hard work, his mum.
It's an unashamedly personal take. I mean, it's romantic, it's sentimental, it's maudlin, it's angry, it has moments of sort of great insight, and it also has moments of, I think, real confusion. I think he's torn about Liverpool. He's torn about his responses to it, that on the one hand, it was awful back then when he was growing up. It was a sort of hard city, it was a harsh city, the class system was kind of ironclad, and yet he looks at it now and he thinks, I don't really recognise it. I can't quite relate to it in the same way.
It's kind of spilling. I've never really seen a documentary like it. It's a kind of a filmic poem, if you like, because there's T.S. Eliot in there, there's Engels, there's Joyce, there's sort of everything. Peggy Lee and the Hollies.
Yeah, it's everything. And of course it does a thing where it will have, you know, a houseman poem and the beauty of that, but then it will have the beauty of the ritual of filling out the football pools and things like
the
that.
The poetry of the ordinary.
So it's investing everything into this sort of crucible of personal memory. There's also a great bit where he starts talking about the Beatles and his sort of loathing of the Beatles. Now, you'd think that he might like the Beatles because the Beatles are seen as the sort of champions of the working class, and they're the people who supposedly broke down this hidebound class system in Liverpool in the 1960s, and yet it was at this point where he was kind of falling in love with classical music. So he hates the Beatles, and at one stage he plays a bit of footage from the Cavern Club and then has classical music playing over.
Yeah, it's a rather brilliant, I think,
and it's
a brilliant sequence.
Superbly done. Yeah. So he's kind of twisting things to his own purpose, really, in a very brazen, open, naked way.
That's Of Time and the City. Zan, we'll move on now to Steve McQueen's Hunger, ostensibly the story of Bobby Sands' hunger strike in 1981, directed by the Turner Prize-winning Steve McQueen. We go into H Block, into the Maze Prison in Belfast, where the prisoners are on dirty protest and blanket protest.
I want to know whether your intent is just purely to commit suicide here.
You want me to argue about the morality of what I'm about to do and whether it's really suicide or not? For one, you're calling it suicide. I call it murder. And that's just another wee difference between us two. We're both Catholic men, both Republicans. But while you were poaching salmon and lovely Kilray, we were being burnt out of our house in Rathcoole.
Right.
Similar in many ways, Dom, but life and experience has focused our beliefs differently. You understand me?
I understand.
I have my belief. And in all its simplicity, that is the most powerful thing.
So what's your statement by dying? Just highlighting British intransigence or what? The whole world knows what the Brits are like.
Good.
It is good. And it's nothing to do with you.
I can feel your hatred, Dom.
Oh, you looking for martyrdom?
No.
You sure?
Aye.
Because I've heard you eulogising Wolfe Tone, Connolly, McSwinney, all them men. Can't help thinking you're writing your name large for all them history books.
Because you think that matters to me.
Oh, I know it does.
Well, you're wrong.
Zan, you say we were lucky to find a bit of dialogue in The Quantum of Solace. We're even luckier, I think, to find a bit of dialogue from Hunger. That was Michael Fassbender as Bobby Sands and Liam Cunningham as the priest in a remarkable middle sequence of the film Hunger, in which Bobby Sands informs the priest he's about to go on hunger strike.
Which I think lasts for something like 17 minutes.
Yeah, I think 22.
22 minutes, right. You obviously saw the director's cut of that. And it's 22 minutes basically in a two-shot, sort of technical term, where they're both basically sitting at a desk facing each other. And it's utterly gripping.
It
and
is.
You keep, you know, the longer it goes on, the more gripping it gets. There's no moment where you think, oh, cut, cut.
And I think it's that stare, isn't
it's
it?
It's intensity. Yeah. But the intensity runs through the film as a whole. I mean, it's an intimate film. It's sort of visceral. It's largely context free. I think it's not a political film in the broader sense. It's a political film in the most sort of intimate sense, in that this is a film where about the body being used as a political weapon. And so it's a film that kind of seems to kind of almost crawl inside the characters. And so it's sort of living there with them. It's not trying to explain them. It's not trying to kind of even look at the wider issues.
Yes,
that are
I mean,
at play.
If you went to it thinking, oh, good, Bobby Sands, I remember that from my youth, as Steve McQueen himself has admitted he did on Film Weekly a couple of weeks ago, it's a name that was kind of floating around, but we never knew too much about him. Only one picture ever published of Bobby Sands, the one that was taken in the jail. If you think, oh, I'll go and find out more about Bobby Sands, I'll go and find out more about the hunger strikes from 1980s Belfast and the political situation. This isn't that film, is
no,
it?
No, it's not that at all. It's trying to do a very different thing here, I think. It reminded me at times of Gus Van Sant's film Elephant, which was kind of obliquely about the Columbine massacre in America. And interestingly, Gus Van Sant's Elephant was based on Alan Clark's Elephant, which is actually about the Troubles.
Yeah.
And it has that same kind of weightless sense of horror.
Another thing that fascinates me about it is that Steve McQueen is a Turner Prize-winning artist, and this is his first feature film, and that it is totally different from other feature films. You mentioned the sort of Gus Van Sant floaty poetry of that later Gus Van Sant period of The Elephants, perhaps. But this one has a sort of structure, more structure to it. It has that kind of opening sequence, which is in the prison, when they're on dirty prison. There's the beatings, and there's the sound, and there's this kind of urine everywhere, and the excrement on the walls. Then there's that long talky segment in the middle that we heard Liam Cunningham. And then there's the sort of final, almost graceful bit where Bobby Sands kind of goes on hunger strike.
Yeah, graceful but deeply harrowing.
Absolutely.
And a superb physical transformation from Michael Fassbender.
He's amazing in it, isn't he?
Absolutely incredible.
Is it the part of a lifetime, or is he a really, really good actor forever?
I don't know. I haven't seen enough of him. He was okay in Eden Lake.
He was all right, wasn't he? Yeah.
But, you know, that's a very different role. This is an incredibly demanding role. And it's a role that maybe the physical transformation might have just been enough. You might have been able to get away with it if you kind of stripped down the weight and basically let Steve McQueen kind of project all this stuff onto you as this sort of sacrificial martyr figure. And yet he brings a kind of warmth and a humour and an anger and a rigour to the part as well.
Absolutely. And it's a grammar that left me with not just thinking about hunger, as in the hunger strike, but a hunger for sort of the normalness of story and character development, which all of this wasn't here. McQueen starves us as all of that to give this kind of new experience in cinema. And I have to recommend anyone seeing it twice, because it's such a shock the first time. And so disorientating that I think when you see it a second time, you're kind of ready for the big bit. You can concentrate for that 22
minutes. See,
maybe
I need to go and see it a second time, because I did admire it to the skies and back. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And yet maybe I was slightly resistant to certain aspects of it. I felt it was at times a little bit mannered, a bit self-conscious. There are too many kind of artistic tableaus going on.
There are.
It stayed with me. I mean, I saw it back in Cannes, and it's kind of still haunted me
absolutely.
Ever since.
There's one scene after the intense talky scene. There's one scene of just a bloke walking along the corridor, brushing the urine away, and it goes on for ages as well. And and you can't take your eyes off this bloke, and all he's doing is walking towards you, pushing piss towards you. Now that is something that you can have your eyes open for. That's Steve McQueen's Hunger. So British cinema in bright array, $100 million worth of Quantum of Solace, of Time in the City, which is two pennies, three bob,
sixpence
as well. The delicious sixpence, and Hunger, which is I don't know how much it cost, but I mean an amazing work that's garnered awards all around the world.
Yeah, I mean it's a fantastic triple whammy, isn't it? I remember right back at the start of this year, they were doing the same thing one week with American cinema. There was one Friday that saw the release of Juno, Diving Bell and the Butterfly, and There Will Be Blood.
Oh, yes, of course. And Peter Bradshaw, of course, said on the front of The Guardian it was the five-star Friday,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Five-star Friday, and it was, you know, this is the great kind of invasion of fantastic American films. And I guess this is British cinema's riposte to that.
Good on us. A big thanks to you, Zan. You can catch all of Zan's reviews and add your own views on various cinematic topics by going to The Guardian's famous film site. That's www.guardian.co.uk/film. One of Britain's finest actors, Ralph Fiennes, was given the Variety UK Achievement in Film Award at the London Film Festival this week. The award celebrates this leading figure's artistic contribution to the industry and to international cinema. Ralph, of course, has starred in films from Anthony Minghella's The English Patient to Steven Spielberg's Schindler's List, David Cronenberg's Spider, and most recently, Ralph excelled in Martin McDonagh's In Bruges and Saul Dibb's The Duchess. I went down to the National Film Theatre at the BFI South Bank to meet up with Ralph before his Variety on stage talk. Ralph Fiennes, congratulations on your Variety in Achievement in UK Film Award.
Thank you very much.
I mean, it must be stressed. This is not a lifetime achievement award. It's achievement so far.
Exactly.
I always feel sort of very concerned when people get them at this stage.
I hope there's a bit more. There's a few other things to do.
Yeah, well, you've got a lot to come this year. I mean, we've seen you in The Duchess. We've had In Bruges this year. You're on stage only over the way there in Oedipus at the moment, and you've got The Reader to come
as
well.
That's right.
I mean, your career does go in these sort of massive spurts of creativity, it seems to me.
Yeah, there's no knowing how things are going to work out, but I find it hard. You know, some things come along, you can't resist saying yes to them.
Yeah, that's. I mean, are there parts? I mean, looking at the sort of mass achievement in UK film, for example, are there parts that you just can't say no to, and are the ones that you have to think hard about?
Well, yeah, there's the ones that you need a lot of persuading to do, and the ones that you see immediately you have to do, and then the ones that you think a little bit about and then do them or don't do them.
what are the ones that you just can't refuse? What is it in the script? Or a character
I was very moved the moment I read David Hare's screenplay of The Reader. That was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I'd read the book some years before and just was completely, it took immediately. I just said, at that point, I thought I wouldn't be available to do it. But anyway, it turned out I was. And also, actually, in Bruges was a Martin McDonagh screenplay, was also. I mean, I never thought I'd be asked to play a role like that. Yeah. So that was immediate.
And you knew which role it was going to be
No, I knew it was going to be Harry, but. Yeah. But it was a fantastic part.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And a great surprise for everyone. I remember the first screening, everyone went, it's you, because you hear your voice first.
Yeah, great entrance, I think, with that long phone conversation.
So is it the drama of a film role that
cause it's just honestly the feeling anyone would have. You read something and you just something inside goes, woof, you know, even if you're just finishing a novel, you have that feeling. Yeah. Fantastic. It's the same feeling. It's a gut feeling of connection and recognition, or something that's just you go, I have to do it. I wonder. Yeah. You can. I guess you can see. Sometimes you think, well, that's like with Harry. I thought, well, that will be a challenge. No one will see me playing that sort of role. But I knew that if Martin can see the bit of me that can get there, And his vote of confidence sort of gave me more confidence to go, yeah, I want to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I was talking to Saul Dibb on this very show not that long ago about The Duchess and how glad he was to have you do it, and that you came up with a performance that he hadn't really envisaged from the script. So that there's a sort of another sort of element to when you choose these roles, that you bring something to it that actually kind of threw him. He said he was delighted about it, but it threw him, and you made more of it than was there.
I enjoyed reading it. The narrative had been manoeuvred to sort of satisfy particular kind of beats that one recognised. Mm. You know, she's unhappy. What's going to happen to her? She finds a man. He's not available. What's going to happen? She's so unhappy. Then, you know, so on, and then and it was a reduction of the novel, but it was okay.
Yeah.
But I thought that part. I just thought there was a way of playing it and spinning it another way, which there. And thinking of it like that, then it appealed to me to do it.
Yeah, is that what appeals about film acting? Because I know you're very careful to balance the both, and you do stage acting, sort of. You return to it as much as a film career permits. Is that the fun of a film career? Because there are very few times you can actually sort of play with a part that so nicely, especially in a sort of bigger production.
When your face is photographed, I think that things are coming through the face which you can't necessarily get on stage. I think there's a sort of magnifying effect. And I think then you can, I'm overanalyzing it really, but I just think you can sort of start to, as it were, the text might be saying one thing or the drama saying one thing, but you can play with the opposite.
Yeah. Now, since this is a UK achievement in film, it's sort of, I suppose one does look at, I've looked at your career anyway in the last, today, I don't know if you've done it, I kind of thought, oh God, what have I done? I mean, there are some monumental roles in there as well. I mean, Amon Göt, of course, which... you know, sticks with me every time now. I mean, it really does. Is there one that you have a favourite thing for, not just for the sort of teeth it allowed you to get into the meat of a role, but for what it did perhaps in your career? You're looking at your career there as well, laid out in some
of what there was. I have some favourite working experiences that have coupled with the films that turned out well. I mean, making Schindler's List was a great working experience. I mean, the day-to-day shooting with Stephen was fantastic. Mm. Working with Fernando Mireles on The Constant Gardener, he's very, very surreal. There's a very strong sense of what's the realness of performance and naturalism of performance.
Rafe, absolute pleasure to see you. Congratulations on the award, and we'll be around for the Lifetime Achievement as well.
Well, should I say don't hold your breath or hold your breath? I'm not sure.
Try both at the same time and not choke. Thank you.
Thank you.
This week was also the nomination week for the 11th British Independent Film Awards. No surprise that films such as Man on Wire, Summer's Town and Happy-Go-Lucky picked up multiple nominations. All of them, of course, featured heavily on Film Weekly throughout the year. But one film on the list has thus far escaped us, and considering its budget and debutant director, it impressed everyone. That film is called Shifty. Directed by Erin Creevy, it premiered at this week's London Film Festival. The film is a humane but harsh look at the street-level drug trade seen through the prism of an old friendship between Chris, played brilliantly by Daniel Mays, and Shifty, played equally brilliantly by Riz Ahmed. For Film Weekly, Jason Phipps went down to the nomination announcements this week to meet up with Erin and to find out how it feels to have picked up 5 nominations and to have your name announced by the very dapper and deep-toned actor Colin Salmon.
Good afternoon, man. The Douglas Hickox Award for Best Debut Director are James Watkins for Eden Lake, Rupert Wyatt, The Escapist, Steve McQueen, Hunger, Martin McDonagh, In Bruges, and Erin Creevy, Shifty. Hardcore choices, yeah.
It's a really sort of kind of far out experience for me at the moment, because I said this, like, my film premiered at the London Film Festival on Friday, and I said this to the audience. I started off as a runner in the film industry, and, you know, and then I went and set up my own production company making music videos and commercials. But whilst I was a runner, you know, times are hard, and I had to get a temping job with Office Angels. I got a temping job with Office Angels, and I was working in Beckton in some really random office in Beckton, and there was no windows on it, and they were doing maintenance on traffic lights, and it was complete. I was thinking, how the hell did I end up getting here? And so whilst I was there, I started writing the script Shifty, or I was in the midst of writing the script Shifty. So I'd get my work out the way at sort of 12 midday, and then spend the rest of the day pretending I was working with my back to the wall, writing Shifty, you know, and then kind of, you know, things happened and I went and set my own production company. But to kind of think back to that time and where I was in my headspace and thinking, God, you know, to see it premiere at the London Film Festival in front of 400 people and then to be nominated here in Soho House and to hear the nominations and you're up against, you know, In Bruges and Steve McQueen with Hunger and these amazing films and you sort of you're regarded in those, in amongst those films, it's an amazing experience. Very humbling as well, because you kind of just got to sort of take it with your stride and think, wow, just, I hope, you know, hope for the best.
Well, I mean, the film itself is about delving into a dark place. How did the actual story come about? I believe it's quite personal to you.
Yeah, I suppose the film's got it's got a semi-autobiographical theme to it, but it's fictionalised to a degree. I mean, what I come from a place in Essex, and the film is based on a real character. There's a real Shifty who was in my town, who went on to become a prolific crack cocaine dealer in and around that town. And one day I bumped into him on the street. And a car pulled up and we were chatting. He's a lovely guy, you know, he's a great guy. He's somebody that you can chat to. He's somebody that's well-read, he's intelligent. He comes from a respectable Muslim family. He just happens to do this for a living. And I saw this drug deal go down in front of me, and there was a girl in the car who was a girl that I used to fancy when I was at school. And she had a horrific burns down the side of her face. And I saw her doing crack in the car in front of me. Then the car drove off. And I turned around to Shifty and I said, what happened to her? And he said, well, she passed out against a radiator and she melted to it when she was whacked out of her face on heroin. And the paramedics had to come and peel her off. So obviously horrified by this story, I had this scene in my head, you know, where I'd seen this happen. And then from that scene outwards, this actual me being there in front of Shifty and this car pulling up and me being sort of an outsider to these experiences, I decided to sort of write this fictionalised story about this guy called Chris, who is Shifty's best mate, who returned to the town after being away for 4 years. And it's kind of through Chris's eyes that you see what's happened to Shifty and where he is now. But it isn't a fundamentally, you know, it's not an unhappy story. It's an optimistic film, and it's full of humour. And I wanted to make sure that I wanted to do an urban film, because I was quite sick and tired of watch urban films, and they seem to have this template and they spray over this template and, you know, they have this template dialogue. And I wanted to say that, you know, I came from a single parent family and I grew up on a council estate, but, you know, we didn't all used to talk like that and talk like rude boys, and it was very funny when there was lots of dialogue, there was lots of banter, and, you know, lots of those people are very intelligent, but they just kind of, you know, they end up in lives that maybe they don't, you know, maybe they, you know, they maybe they got stuck and they didn't know a way out.
Can you talk about the Microwave Initiative and Film London's initiative? This is the first film really to be funded on that basis, and obviously Film London would be delighted with your 5 nominations. What was the budget roughly?
The budget was that we couldn't make the film for a penny more than 100,000, and that's delivering the film as well. That was the entire budget. It wasn't like we shot the film for 100 grand, then there was loads of other money raised in order to finish it off. We actually had to finish it all for, and that part of the scheme is that you can't make it for a penny more than 100 grand. So even the music was, you know, came in under that. The score, which has been nominated as well, which is great news for Molly Nyman and Harry Escott. But it doesn't look like a 100 grand film when you see it on the screen, which is kind of down to very kindly lots of people being helping us out and making these things happen.
This is a credit crunch production, is it?
Yeah, it's a total credit crunch production.
Yeah, well, you and Shane Meadows have proven that you can come up with very good quality on very, very low money.
Yeah, exactly. I think, I never wrote to scale with Shifty, even though I think the story fitted the scheme, the 100 grand, and I said, but I think for any sort of budding writers out there, you should never, I don't think, write to scale. Don't sort of write, think, oh, I'm going to try and write a film for 100 grand, because I think I wasn't aware of that. I just tried to write a film about my sort of experiences, which are slightly semi-autobiographical, and it just so happened to fit the scheme.
Our congratulations to Aaron Creevy there, and Shifty has no release date as of yet, but has been picked up by Metrodome, so it will be out later next year, and of course the whole gang will be back on Film Weekly to discuss it with us then. You can read what I thought about Shifty and the whole of the LFF in my Observer Roundup coming out this Sunday alongside my Trailer Trash column, but until Sunday, that's all I've got time for. So my thanks to my guests on Film Weekly this week, Mark Forster, to Rafe Fiennes, and of course to Aaron Creevy. Until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.